Hello, dear listeners. Whether you're just finding us or have been with us for a while, welcome. At Dreams and Crimes, we've got a treasure trove of stories waiting to be discovered. We like to describe them as a cozy blanket after a long day of work, or a ticket to a thrilling adventure before bed. If you're a long-time listener, thanks for sticking with us. Your support means the world. Want to take it up a notch? Consider subscribing to Dreams and Crimes on Apple Podcasts or YouTube. We're cooking up something special, turning these stories into videos. We've put a lot of efforts into them, and they're actually super good. And now, let's dive into today's story. The Tiger Parents. Tiger parenting is a term used to describe a style of strict, demanding parenting popular within the Chinese community. Every parent wants their child to achieve greatness of some sort, whether it be sports, the arts, or academia, but a tiger parent is a completely different animal. Tiger parents are obsessive with their child's success and push their influence on their children to the extreme. A typical tiger parent would expect their child to attend an Ivy League school like Harvard, Princeton, or Yale. They also might regulate who their child dates so they marry into a good family. Ultimately, their goal is to make sure their child gets a lucrative job such as Wall Street lawyer, investment banker, or highly paid surgeon. Hui Han Pan and Bic Han Pan were stereotypical tiger parents. Han had immigrated to Toronto, Canada as a refugee, and his wife Bic followed shortly after. The two married after their arrival in Canada and got jobs working for an auto parts manufacturer. By the late 80s, they had two children, Jennifer and Felix. The Pans led an extremely thrifty life, saving as much as they possibly could. By 2004, they had $200,000 in the bank and owned a nice-sized home in a suburban neighborhood. Their sole extravagancies were their cars, a Mercedes and a Lexus. Their main objective was to save enough to send their kids to the best schools and make sure they were eligible for any possible scholarships. They wanted to make absolutely sure that Jennifer and Felix lived a more plentiful life than they did. Their firstborn, Jennifer Pan, showed potential at an early age. By the age of 4, she was already taking piano lessons, proving to be exceptional. In her elementary school years, she started figure skating. Some evenings, Bic and Han would keep her up practicing until 10 p.m. and then homework until midnight. At graduation from middle school, Jennifer was expected to be valedictorian of her class, but was turned down. She was devastated, and her parents even more so. The pressure on Jennifer was immense, more than a girl in her early teens could handle. She told her friends that she would just put on her happy mask, but deep down she was suffering and began cutting her forearms with tiny cuts. Jennifer attended high school at Mary Ward Catholic Secondary School in Toronto. The school was known for its unique self-directed learning program with uncommonly high academic standards. Jennifer fitted in well and got along with almost everyone. Her parents monitored her after-school activities closely, in which she became an avid swimmer and practiced wushu, a Chinese form of kung fu. In band class, Jennifer excelled at playing the flute. Though she was an accomplished ice skater, her skills began to slip. A second place in a skating competition just wasn't enough for her demanding parents, and her confidence began to slip. At one point, she was an Olympic hopeful in figure skating, but those hopes were quashed when she tore a ligament in her knee. In earlier years, Jennifer was a straight-A student, but by the end of ninth grade, her grades in everything but music had slipped considerably. Knowing that a C or even a B wasn't going to sit well with her parents, Jennifer got creative. Armed with her old report cards, glue stick, scissors, and a quick trip to Kinko's, she was able to create the straight-A report cards that her parents expected. But she knew she would have to improve her grades before the final 2 years of high school if she wanted to get into college. Jennifer's activities out of school were closely monitored by her parents. Even into her 20s, she had never been allowed to go out with friends without close supervision. She had never been drunk or gone to a nightclub. She felt as though she was missing out on her childhood, and the controlling nature of her parents infuriated her. In her junior year of high school, Jennifer travelled with the school band to Europe, playing the flute. When the band played an auditorium that allowed smoking, Jennifer had an asthma attack. A fellow student and trumpet player, Daniel Wong, took her outside and calmed her down. Daniel was a chubby, funny, and happy-go-lucky kid. He was also a part-time pot dealer. When he took the time to take care of Jennifer, it impressed her, and it wasn't long before they were dating. But of course, she would have to hide the relationship from her parents. By the time senior year rolled around, Jennifer's grades still hadn't improved, and she had continued forging her report cards. She had already been accepted to attend Ryerson University the following year, but when she failed her calculus class, Ryerson dropped her. Not only was she not going to be going to university, she wasn't even going to graduate from high school with that failing grade. Nervous that her parents would find out, Jennifer continued forging documents. As far as they knew, she was going to Ryerson. She told them she would take 2 years of science and then would transfer to the University of Toronto's pharmacology program, just as her father had planned. Her father, Han, was ecstatic and bought her a new laptop for school. Jennifer forged receipts for tuition and a $3,000 scholarship, bought used textbooks, and left every morning for school. But instead of going to school, she took the bus downtown and hung out at cafes and public libraries all day. She studied scientific subjects and filled her notebooks with notes as if she was attending class. She also spent time with Daniel, who was attending York University. She taught piano lessons when she could and worked part-time days at the pizza place where Daniel worked as the kitchen manager. When Jennifer arrived home in the evenings, she made up elaborate stories about her lessons, teachers, and other students. She told very few friends of the huge lie she was telling her parents, knowing that if friends knew, it may eventually get around to her parents. Eventually, Jennifer convinced her parents to let her move in with her friend Topaz 3 nights a week. Topaz lived closer to campus, and she wouldn't have to make the long commute every day. But this was just another lie on top of all the others. She actually moved in with Daniel and his parents. His parents constantly asked to meet with her parents, but she made excuse after excuse. After 2 years of lying to her parents about Ryerson University, it was time for her to transfer to the University of Toronto. She found someone online to print her a fake transcript. Graduation from Ryerson was going to be tricky. Jennifer came up with an elaborate excuse that her graduating class was too large and students would only be allowed one guest. Rather than choose between her mother and father, she gave her guest invitation to a friend so that both of her parents could attend. Jennifer's parents still didn't even know that she had a boyfriend. If they had known, they would have forbidden it. Though she lived with Daniel 3 nights a week, she wanted to stay more. She told her parents that she was going to volunteer at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children in their blood testing lab, so she would need to stay in the city on the weekends as well. This was the first time that her parents suspected her of lying. Her father knew that if she was working at the hospital, she would need a uniform and a keycard, but she didn't have them. Han convinced his wife, Bic, to follow her, but Jennifer knew she was being followed. Jennifer went to the hospital and sat in a waiting room all day until she was convinced that her mother was gone. Her parents still knew that she was up to something, and the next morning they confronted Topaz, who broke the news to them that Jennifer had never lived there and was instead living with Daniel. When they confronted her, Jennifer confessed. She told her parents that she wasn't volunteering at the hospital, she wasn't attending the University of Toronto, and she was staying with Daniel. But she still didn't tell them that she had never attended Ryerson University and hadn't even finished high school. Jennifer's father was beyond livid. His first instinct was to kick her out of the house, but her mother, who was much more lenient than her father, intervened. Her parents forbade Jennifer from leaving the house for 2 weeks. During her time at home, Jennifer's mother spent as much time as she could with Jennifer. Though her father had taken her phone away from her and insisted on no contact with Daniel or any friends, her mother occasionally let her have access to her phone. In February 2009, Jennifer wrote on Facebook, "Living in my house is like living under house arrest. No one person knows everything about me, and no two people put together knows everything about me. I like being a mystery." Eventually, she got access to her phone, and though she was forbidden from having any contact with Daniel ever again, she would sneak phone calls and texts, and she would occasionally sneak out of the house. Every chance she got between teaching piano lessons, she would sneak to Daniel's house. Her parents eventually allowed her to retake her calculus class to get the one last credit she needed to get her high school diploma. Then she would need to apply for any school that would take her. Her father was convinced that it wasn't too late and she could still become a pharmacy lab technician or a nurse. Meanwhile, Daniel was getting sick of all the sneaking around. She was 24 years old, but her parents had full control over her love life. Eventually, Daniel broke up with her and started seeing another girl, Christine. Jennifer grew insanely jealous and concocted an elaborate story to regain his attention. She told Daniel that a man had come to her door claiming to be a police officer and showing his badge. When she opened the door, a group of men pushed their way into her home and gang-raped her. She then told him that the following day she had received a bullet in the mail. Jennifer told Daniel it was all a warning from his new girlfriend. She claimed Christine was trying to keep them apart. By the spring of 2010, Jennifer had had enough. Her father was tearing her life apart and she wanted it to end. She wanted her parents dead. In high school, she had heard stories of a boy named Andrew Montemayor. The rumour was that he had robbed people at knife point and had once considered killing his own father. She contacted Montemayor, but he wouldn't have anything to do with her plan, but told her that his roommate, Ricardo Duncan, might be interested. According to Jennifer, she paid him $1,500 that she had earned from teaching piano, but then never heard from him again. Jennifer and Daniel were texting again, and she shared her thoughts with him. She explained that her parents were worth about $1 million, and if they were out of the picture, she was set to inherit $500,000. If her parents were dead, she and Daniel could live their life with no sneaking around, and they could finally be happy. During his weed-dealing days, Daniel had met a guy named Lenford Crawford who went by the nickname Homeboy. Daniel thought that if anyone knew how to hook something like that up, it would be Homeboy. Sure enough, he did. Daniel set up a meeting between Jennifer and Crawford, and they agreed on a price. Crawford told her the going rate was $20,000, but for a friend of Daniel, he would only charge $10,000. Jennifer agreed, and said that once she got her inheritance, it wouldn't be a problem. Crawford gave Jennifer an iPhone and a SIM card. This phone and SIM would be used strictly for when they spoke and would then be destroyed after the deed was done. Though Daniel knew of the plan and knew Jennifer's deepest, darkest secrets, he was still in love with Christine. He told Jennifer he wanted out of the plan. She texted him, "Jennifer, so you feel for her what I feel for you, then call it off with Homeboy. Daniel, I thought you wanted this for you. Jennifer, I do, but I have nowhere to go. Daniel, call it off with Homeboy. You said you wanted this with or without me. Jennifer, I want it for me." The next day, Daniel confirmed it was all still going to happen. "Daniel, I did everything and lined it all up for you." Despite Daniel professing his love for Christine, his flirtatious texts still continued in the days after. In early November 2010, Crawford texted Jennifer, "I need time of completion. Think about it." She replied, "Today is a no-go. Dinner plans out. We won't be home in time." Eventually, Crawford and Jennifer agreed on a date, Monday, November 8th.
commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
At 9:30 p.m. on Monday night, Bik Pan had just returned home from a night of line dancing with her friends. Her husband Han had retired early and was already in bed. Jennifer's younger brother Felix was away at college, and Jennifer was in her bedroom watching television. Bik kicked off her shoes and filled a foot bath with warm water to soak her feet and watched some TV in the living room before going to bed. At 9:35 p.m, Jennifer came downstairs, asked her mother about her night, kissed her goodnight, and discreetly unlocked the front door. She then went to her bedroom and spoke on her iPhone for 3.5 minutes. At 10:02, Jennifer turned an upstairs bedroom light on, then 1 minute later turned it off. That was the signal that the door was unlocked. Jennifer then sent a text. VIP access. Moments later, three men came through the unlocked front door. Lenford Homeboy Crawford, David Milvanganam, and Eric Sniper Carty. All had guns drawn. One man ran up the stairs to the room where Han was sleeping and put a gun in his face. He demanded that Han go downstairs where another man was watching over Bik. Bik and Han spoke to each other in Cantonese, wondering what they wanted when one of the men yelled, "Shut up. You talk too much. Where's the fucking money?" Han assured him he only had $60 in his wallet, and Bik pleaded with her assailants, "Please, don't hurt my daughter." The third man, Carty, went up the stairs and met with Jennifer outside of her bedroom. Jennifer handed him $2,500 in cash and showed him another $1,100 that her mother kept in her nightstand. He then tied her arms behind her back with a shoelace and led her downstairs with her parents. The men took Jennifer back upstairs and tied her to the stairway railings while they took her parents downstairs to the basement. Moments later, 5 shots rang out. Han was shot twice, once in the face and once in the shoulder. Bik was shot 2 times in the back and once in the head. Though Bik died instantly, Han was bleeding profusely but still alive. After 18 minutes in the house, the three men left through the front door and left Jennifer alive upstairs. Jennifer's Samsung flip phone was tucked into the waistband of her pants. Despite being tied with her hands behind her back, she pulled the phone out, flipped it open, and dialed 911. "Help me, please. I need help. I don't know where my parents are. Please hurry. What's your name?" "My name is Jennifer. Someone just broke in. Someone broke in and I heard shots like pop. I don't know what's happening. I'm tied upstairs." "Did it sound like gunshots?" "I don't know what gunshots sound like. I just heard a pop." Screaming in the background. "I'm okay. My dad just went outside screaming." "Do you think your mum is downstairs too?" "I don't hear her anymore. Please hurry. I don't know what's happening." The screaming that was heard 34 seconds into the 911 call was Han Pan. Covered in blood, Han crawled out of the basement and back to the main floor of the house. He then ran outside, screaming as loudly as he could. Nearby neighbours heard his screams and called 911 as well. When police and emergency crews arrived to the home, they found Jennifer upstairs tied to the banister just as she had said, her flip phone laid on the floor next to her. Han Pan was rushed to the hospital, where he was put into a medically induced coma. At 3 a.m, Jennifer was brought in for her first interrogation. She told police that 3 black males had burst into the house, had taken whatever cash they could find, and had shot her parents. Police asked her to explain how she managed to pull her flip phone out of her waistband while tied to a banister. She demonstrated that she reached around her waist, flipped the phone open with her thumb, and turned the volume all the way up. She showed that making the call was possible, but still left a lot of unanswered questions. If it was a robbery, why did they leave so many valuable items in the house? Why did they not bring duffel bags or backpacks to carry what they had stolen? Why did they not take the Lexus or the Mercedes when the keys were there in plain view? How did they get in the front door so easily? If they had planned on killing two people, why leave a third as a witness? The biggest question police had was, why did Han come up the stairs and run outside for help when he knew his daughter was still in the house? Why did he not try to help her? Their questions would be answered a few days later. Detectives set up 24-hour surveillance on Jennifer and even followed her to her mother's funeral. During the funeral, detectives noticed she had a lack of tears or emotion as they lay her mother in the ground. When Han awoke from his induced coma, his neck bone was shattered, bones in his face were broken near his eye, there were bullet fragments lodged in his face, and a bullet had clipped his carotid artery. Though he was barely alive, Han remembered everything and had a story to tell that differed greatly from the story Jennifer told. Han told police that Jennifer's story was all lies, like everything else about her life. He said that when the men rushed in, he was taken downstairs at gunpoint into the living room with his wife. When he looked for his daughter, Jennifer, he saw her speaking in a friendly manner with a white man and walking around the house with him without any restraint. Police had already interviewed Jennifer twice, but on November 22nd brought her in for a third interview. 2 hours into the interview, Detective Bill Gertz began what is referred to as the Reed technique. The Reed technique is a controversial interrogation procedure that was developed in the 50s to evoke a confession. It has been banned in most European countries because it involves deceptive techniques such as lying to the suspect about the evidence against them and invading their personal space. The procedure has been accused of leading to many false confessions, but it's still in use in most of the United States and Canada. Using this technique, Gertz falsely told Jennifer that police use satellites and infrared technology to view activity within buildings and they had software that could tell if a person was lying. Jennifer succumbed to the interrogation and admitted that she hired the men, but not to kill her parents. She told police she had hired them to kill her. She claimed that she had tried to commit suicide many times in the past, but had failed every time. She said she had hired a hit on herself. I didn't want to be here anymore. She told police that her parents wouldn't allow her to see Daniel Wong anymore, and she wanted to end her life. She said the men were already outside the house when she decided to call it off, but they demanded the money anyway and burst into the house. She claimed that she couldn't pay them, so they shot her family instead. The cops didn't buy her story. They arrested her and brought Daniel Wong in for questioning. Daniel confirmed that she was lying once again, as she did with everything in her life. Despite Jennifer destroying the SIM card, police were able to recover text messages from her iPhone and Daniel's phone to confirm her arrangement with the hitmen. Jennifer, Daniel, and the three hitmen were charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. Jennifer's trial lasted almost 10 months, and she took the stand in her own defense for 7 days, but it was no use. When she was handed the guilty verdict, she initially showed no emotion. Once the cameras left the room, she burst into tears and shook uncontrollably. Jennifer Pan was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. Daniel, Milvaganam, and Crawford all got the same sentence. Jennifer was also given a non-communication order. She was no longer allowed to have any contact with the other defendants or anyone in her family. When Carty's lawyer became ill, his trial was declared a mistrial and was postponed. In December 2015, Carty pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit murder and was sentenced to 18 years in prison with parole eligibility after 9 years. Han Pan still suffers with his injuries and is unable to work. He released a statement after the trial which read, "When I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. I don't feel like I have a family anymore. Some say I should feel lucky to be alive, but I feel like I am dead too. I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what's happened to her family and can become a good, honest person someday."
Thanks for listening to True Crime Sleep Stories. If you aren't asleep yet, consider following the show. Maybe our next story will give you the peace of mind you desperately need. Or not.